Hi, and welcome to the 9Gs podcast, an aviation podcast. Today's episode special guest is Justin Hazard Lee. Justin Lee is a former F-16 and current F-35 pilot in the United States Air Force. He's flown 82 combat missions, mostly in Afghanistan, and was awarded 4 air medals. He now flies and instructs on the F-35 Lightning II from Luke Air Force Base. He's as well the host of the Professionals Playbook podcast. His show was ranked as a 2019 top podcast. Justin, thank you very much for joining me on the 9Gs podcast. It's a real pleasure having you here.
Mateo, it's a pleasure to be on here.
First thing first, Justin, I know you've flown the F-16, you're flying the F-35, but where did you grow up and how did you get into aviation?
Yeah, so I grew up in Los Alamos, New Mexico, and I remember going to an air show when I was 5 years old, and I saw the Thunderbirds fly. And I knew from then on I wanted to be a fighter pilot. This was back in the day when you could climb into a cockpit of, I think it was an F-15, and you could put on the helmet. And you can imagine I was 5 years old with this big helmet on, looked like a bobblehead. But from then on, I knew I wanted to be a fighter pilot, had all the toys. And there's not a lot you can do. You can't fly like little airplanes. I guess you can fly models, but you can't really, you know, work towards a pilot license until around high school. And so I got my first flight in a Cessna 152 in Los Alamos, New Mexico. And the interesting thing about the runway is it's on a cliff. So as soon as you take off, you are 1,000 feet over the canyon. And it was the most incredible experience. I only was able to get about 12 hours because I was having to pay for it while working at McDonald's, which is not a good strategy. So I got 12 hours and then I wanted to go to the Air Force Academy. I got a letter from the academy and it said, unfortunately, we don't have the room for you. And so I was pretty crushed because I thought that was the only path to becoming a pilot. A few weeks later, I got a letter saying, if I went to another school for a year and kept my grades up, then I could go to the Air Force Academy. And went there, kept my grades up, and entered the Air Force Academy in 2005.
Then you've done all your training curriculum in the U.S. Air Force. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Sure, yeah. So I got a pilot slot out of the Air Force Academy. And from there, I went to Vance Air Force Base in Oklahoma. And you start off, you first actually start off in Diamond DA-20, so low performance prop planes, and you fly that for about 6 weeks, and they're just trying to assess, do you have what it takes to go to the next level? And so did that for 6 weeks, and then from there you go to the T-6 Texan II, and it's a high performance prop plane, 1,100 horsepower. It reminds me of like a P-51 Mustang, and it was an incredible experience. It's broken into 4 phases. First, you're just learning how to fly from point A to point B. Next, you're learning how to do aerobatics. After that, you're learning how to fly instruments. And then after that, you learn how to fly in formation. And it was the most incredible experience. I didn't really like school too much. I liked sports, but this was a way to combine the two. And I fell in love with flying with the T-6. And so we started with a class of 30 people. And I can remember the first day the wing commander came in and gave us a pep talk and said, all right, I want you to close your eyes. How many of you want to be fighter pilots? Raise your hand. All right, open your eyes. All 30 people had their hands raised. And he said, good luck, and walked out. And so at the end of T-6s, we had 7 people go to the T-38. So those were on the fighter track. That was me. We had 3 people wash out. And then we had 20 people or so go to the T-1. And that's like a business jet. So they go on to fly the tankers and the cargo planes. But yeah, 7 of us went to the T-38, and it's a supersonic jet trainer designed back way in the 50s. So it has small engines, looks like a dart, tiny wings. So it can barely go supersonic, but then the low speed handling characteristics are not good at all on the T-38. So it's actually the fastest aircraft that I've had to learn how to land in, which is pretty tricky. T-38s, you repeat the same phase. And at the end of it, there were 4 fighter slots given out. And so I got an F-16 slot and then came out to Luke Air Force Base.
What kind of aircraft did you have as a slot?
So you put down a dream sheet. And back then, there was not an F-22 option because they were only dropping F-22s at certain times of the year. So our class was actually extremely lucky. typically there's one or two fighter slots, but our flight commander went out and actually took aircraft from the next class because we were such a strong class. And so we were able to get three F-16 slots and one F-15E slot. And that was my first choice of the available aircraft, because you rank it based on what you want and then the needs of the Air Force. And those two combined to give you what aircraft you fly. But it was up to that point the best day of my life to get a F-16, because it was the realization of a 20-year dream.
Were you specialized in any particular mission in the F-16? I know the F-16 is omni-role, but do you have any specialization according to the squadron you're going to be assigned on?
Well, when you go to the B course, which is out here in Phoenix, Arizona, you learn from the beginning. So it's, again, just learning how to take off, how to land. Then you do BFM, dogfighting. You do more long-range tactical intercepts, and then you do air-to-surface. So you're learning everything, but only surface level deep. And from there, I got my first base, and that was going to be in Kunsan, South Korea. You go to Korea, and you're still not done yet. You still have mission qualification training, which is 3 or 4 months. And so you've been through all this training, you've gone through all this selection, and you think you're pretty hot stuff. And your primary job is to stock the snack bar, making sure that they have Cokes available. So you have to be pretty humble and work your way up from there. But we were doing mostly air interdiction. We were doing all the mission sets, but in Korea, our primary job was to fight our way into a target area, drop some bombs, and fight our way out. So air interdiction. And so I did that for a year and a half. And then I went to Shaw Air Force Base in South Carolina. And that's where they're one of six Air Force squadrons that can do the suppression of enemy air defense role, the SEED role. And so it was, yeah, our job was to take out the SAM sites, which is an incredible job. That was one of the most fun times that I've had during that assignment.
Yeah, I can't imagine. Is it very usual to be assigned directly overseas?
Yeah. So that wasn't based on skill at all. We, again, put down our dream sheet, and I actually think we rolled dice to see where we went. And so there's Italy, there's Germany, there is Japan, and then I rolled South Korea. So it wasn't any skill or anything like that.
Yeah. So back in the States, I think you flown your first operational missions. Can you tell us a bit about that? I think it was in Afghanistan.
Yeah, in 2016, we deployed to Afghanistan, and the war had died down quite a bit in 2016. So the first 1 or 2 months was pretty quiet. But then Secretary of Defense Mattis took over, and there's ISIS was starting to rear its head. So he ordered that he wanted all ISIS annihilated, and overnight, everything changed. And we were the only fighter squadron in the entire country because things had died down. So we were in charge of the whole area of responsibility, the AOR, and we were dropping every bomb we had, every mission. And there's just a two-ship of F-16s airborne at any given time. So as the flight lead, you'd be in charge of 100% of the fast CAS, close air support aircraft in country. And so we would just go from firefight to firefight, helping out the troops on the ground. Or if there's a high-value target or something like that, we would engage that. So we ended up at the end of that deployment dropping the most ordnance since the opening days of the war. It wasn't too bad from a threat perspective, but when you're flying a single-engine airplane, your two-ship is the only fighters airborne. We're sometimes doing yo-yo ops, which means we'd have a tanker about 100 miles away, we'd be on station and we'd want to maintain persistent coverage. So I would send myself to the tanker, leave my wingman on station. And so I was flying exclusively at night. And so you do, the hair on the back of your neck does stand up, you know, you're pretty comfortable in the cockpit, but you always know you're 5 minutes away from that engine failing, you having to eject and outrun a bunch of Taliban and ISIS that are trying to get you.
Yeah. Have you been shot at during this deployment?
Yeah, I was shot light arms fire. So again, there are fighter pilots that have seen much, much more than me. But yeah, I was able to strafe a couple times, and there's some AK-47 rounds that was shot my way.
I know that sometimes combat missions can be very demanding. Did you have any mental preparation to do that?
So I guess it goes back to the Air Force Academy. I used to box there, and the Air Force Academy is co-located in Colorado Springs with the Olympic Training Center. And so they would send over sports psychologists to work with us. And so they'd go over meditation, visualization, staying in the present moment, self-talk. And I've been able to use that throughout pilot training. And so, yeah, I was using that quite a bit in Afghanistan. And actually, I'm sure we'll get to it later, but we're utilizing that in a more structured environment here at Luke Air Force Base, training the next generation of pilots. And so now we have sports psychologists assigned to every squadron, physical therapists as well. So we're treating the pilots a lot more like athletes. But yeah, that mental preparation helped out a lot because, as you know, when you're flying, there are thousands of decisions to be made. You don't have all the information. So you're going to make some mistakes along the way, especially when you're flying a 7-8 hour mission. And so when you make a mistake, you just got to let that go in the past and keep pressing. There are a lot of decisions to be made. You got to just keep staying in the moment and not worry about the past. But yeah, it was pretty stressful out there. And I started meditating consistently out there. And it really helped out. Just 10 minutes in the morning, focusing on the breathing, which I think is a good testing ground for being able to control your thoughts, being able to realize that you're drifting away and thinking and being able to let it go. And so you're doing that in a controlled environment, essentially practicing it so that when you're doing it in a stressful environment with lives on the line, you have that practice.
I'm sure you've done that preparing some CAS missions. CAS missions were the main missions flown in Afghanistan, I'm sure.
It was a mix. So we would be doing all sorts of different things. But yeah, close air support, we did that quite a bit, supporting the troops on the ground. And that's probably the most rewarding mission set that I've done in my career. Being able to help them out. You can hear it on their voices that they're stressed. You can hear the gunfire in the background and you're able to work with them, which it's pretty tough to do, as you know, to find out where the good guys are, where the bad guys are, avoid the civilians and take out the bad guys. And you can hear the relief in the voices from the guys on the ground.
Yeah, especially avoiding any friendly casualties because it can be very tricky sometimes, especially when troop in contact situations.
Absolutely. It's messy, it's difficult, and especially in a environment like Afghanistan where there's a lot of civilians out there and they're in and amongst the friendlies, it can be difficult. And we had to drop quite a few danger close munitions where there is a decent chance that the munition was going to injure the friendlies, but based on the accuracy and the concentration of the enemy gunfire, we and they decided it was worth it.
Yeah. How many deployments have you done?
I've done one combat deployment. So that was the one combat deployment I've been on, and also the tour in South Korea for a year and a half.
Yeah, okay. Coming back from your combat deployment, I'm pretty sure your physical health was very good, working out every day, I'm sure. But how was your mental health? We know that sometimes returning from enemy territories, going to your home country, you will have some mental health issues.
Yeah, I was a little bit on edge coming back. And I also felt that everything that was going on in the States was so irrelevant. People were worrying about, grocery store, they were out of milk, or just their parking spot was too far away. Just all this stuff that just seemed worthless when you're coming back from a combat zone where people are dying and you're having to make life and death decisions. So again, being a pilot, you're a little bit removed from it. You're able to disconnect from the mission, go back to your base. So I can really empathize with the troops on the ground who are in the mud, who don't get that break, who are under fire, and they come back and they have some mental issues. So I can definitely see what was going on there, and that it's a big deal. But yeah, after a few months, I was back to normal.
Every pilot coming back from combat missions, combat deployments, regardless their country, they always have what you just described. And this is very interesting. I think that is more efficiently evaluated right now.
I'm just really glad that it's now out in the open. I know in previous wars, it was not. So I think the first step is identifying it. And so when we come back, we have 6 mandatory counseling sessions, and it's not enough. And hopefully we can expand that, but it is a first step, and we've identified the problem, and hopefully we can be more open about it, because I think having it out in the light is really what will be the start to solving it.
Yeah, exactly. So you came back in 2016 from your deployment.
Yeah, so I actually found out in Afghanistan, my follow-on assignment was my number one choice, which was to go to Luke Air Force Base in Phoenix, Arizona, which is where my wife's from, and fly the F-35, which at the time was, there weren't a lot of slots to do that.
Yeah, so I'm sure you've flown the F-35A version that is currently in use in the U.S. Air Force. The specificity of the F-35 is that you don't have any twin seats. You have only single seat. How is the training going on of flying this F-35 directly on the single seat?
So it's not too difficult for previous fighter pilots. So when I first got here, it was all experienced pilots coming to the F-35. And it's actually modeled, the HOTAS, hands-on throttle and stick, are very similar to the F-16. So it's pretty easy to jump in the simulator and learn how to fly it. And you have that bank of experiences to be able to take off and land when you're actually flying the jet. But in 2018, we got our first batch of, we call them B-coursers, people straight from pilot training coming to the F-35. And so, yeah, their first flight is by themselves. And they're coming from a T-38, which is just, that 1950s aircraft. And so learning how to fly a $100 million aircraft, and they're taking off by themselves. And so we would tell them, no matter what, your butt's going to be back on the ground in 2.5 hours. So hopefully you can bring this thing back. So it's been an interesting challenge, but simulators have gotten pretty good, and we haven't had any issues with them taking off and landing.
Yeah. Did you have any feedback from those ab initio pilots flying directly the F-35 from the T-38?
Yeah, we're always constantly learning to iterate and tweak things, and the syllabus is always changing and timelines are changing. So we're cutting things or adding things. But I think it goes back to just fundamentals, making sure that they're solid on those and you can grow from there.
What's the bread and butter of this aircraft?
So the F-35 is one of two fifth generation fighters that the US has. Fourth generation fighters, a lot of them were modeled off of John Boyd's energy management, where it's all about how fast you can turn and how long you can sustain that turn. Whereas fifth generation fighters, which really started with F-22 in 2005, are about being stealth, about having great sensors, sensor fusion, being able to network all together, and lastly, to be able to fly in a high angle of attack regime. So the F-35 is an awesome aircraft. I know it had some bad press early on, but that's really, in my opinion, because the jet, it was one of the first jets to grow up in the social media age. So that, coupled with concurrency, where we didn't just build a test fleet like we did with previous aircraft, where you just build 10 airplanes and then fly them till the wings basically fell off, learned all the things that was wrong with it, and then incorporate those changes in follow-on production aircraft. We just started building them and knowing that we'd have to go back and fix some of the errors that would be built in there. So that was a way to collapse the timeline.
I think you were as well very lucky to be able to have all the lessons learned from the F-22, having the stealth technology and all the tactical stuff you were able to adapt. And because I think that flying a stealth fighter, especially in air-to-air situations, and I'm pretty sure in the air interdiction situation as well, is very different than flying a conventional aircraft.
Yeah, so they were able to definitely incorporate lessons learned. That's probably the biggest thing that we as fighter pilots stress, is developing lessons learned at the end of it. And sure, they were able to develop a bunch of lessons learned and get better. And I actually had a chance to go out to the factory. It was about 6 months ago or so. And it's an incredible factory. It's in Fort Worth, Texas, and it's a mile long. So you can barely see to the other end, and there are F-35s, just dozens of F-35s being built. And it's pretty cool because there is a TV screen right in front of each one, and you can see what country it's going to, what units it's going to, what percentage of the way it's been built. And yeah, I remember they showed us the first bay where the first F-35 was built, and it took years to build. And each task that they found that wasn't perfect, they put a sticky note to change it on the wall. And this wall, they showed pictures of it afterwards, just filled with sticky notes. And to see it go from that to what it is now, where they're cranking out an entire F-35 every day that the production facility is operating. It's mind-boggling.
One of the most impressive features of the F-35 is the HMS, the Head Mounted Sight System. What is the main difference from this HMS to the F-16's one?
Yeah, so the first helmet was like the 55P, just the old school helmet, nothing on there, no technology, and you have a heads-up display in the F-16. And so at the time, that was pretty advanced, and that helped out with the pilot getting more information and not having to look down at all the steam gauges and build his or her situational awareness. And when I flew the F-16, we had JHMCS, so Joint Helmet Mounted Cueing System. And so we still had a HUD heads-up display in front of us, but we had limited augmented reality on there. So you could put little circles down and triangles down and things like that. And it helped out quite a bit, especially like close air support. You could see where your sensors were pointed at relative to where you're looking at. And this is that helmet on steroids. So it's the HMD on the F-35 is incredible. We actually got rid of the heads-up display, so we don't have that anymore. All information is pumped directly into the helmet. And that was an engineering challenge. And again, they had some issues and bugs to work out. But at this point, there's no way I'd want to go back to a heads-up display. And it saves weight. And the cool thing is it's true augmented reality. So it puts circles over the good guys. It puts diamonds over the bad guys. Yeah, at night, we have mid-wave IR cameras around the jet. And so the jet stitches those images together and can pump it into the helmet. And so that's where, you know, it's been in the news where you can see through your body. So it's really a great capability, and it's great for putting a lot of data into our hands that's in a manageable way. So it's almost like you're driving a car down the road and you say, I want to see all the restaurants, and click a button. And then now you see circles over all the restaurants and you're like, all right, I want to see Indian food restaurants. And then you see diamonds over them. So it's a pretty incredible capability, and it really helps us to maintain situational awareness.
Yeah, with all that kind of features, especially with the camera stuff, did you have any special disorientation due to that?
No, I have not. It is something to worry about when you're switching jets. So it took me about a year to really get comfortable with the F-35. Even coming from the F-16, which the F-35 was pretty much designed, the design was based on it. So it took me a while to get comfortable. I remember I would know what to do in my mind because I was pretty experienced as a fighter pilot, but it would take me about 5 seconds to manipulate the switches, which, as you know, we're closure rates averaging a mile every 3 seconds. It's much too slow. So it took me about a year, but that is something we really watch out for in the first couple of flights. It's a mid-wave IR camera as opposed to night vision goggles. So it's quite a bit different. And so, yeah, you really want to take baby steps first before you start running and doing all kinds of crazy maneuvers in it. But I haven't had any sort of spatial disorientation in the F-35. It does a much, much better job of giving me the data that I want. And the F-16 was designed in the 70s. And there was 70s technology in it, 80s, 90s, 2000s, as we tried to continue to upgrade it. And so every sensor was tied to a different screen. For instance, my radar warning wasn't integrated at all with my radar. And so I had to look at both of them. And in fact, in the F-16, we had 6 times the controlled flight into terrain of other aircraft, where the pilot's just looking around, looking at their radar, and ends up running into a mountain and killing himself. So it's... Yeah. That 35 fuses all that information together, and it puts a red dot if it's a bad guy, green dot if it's a good guy.
What are the main performances in terms of speed, G-load, and maximum altitude of the F-35?
So 2018, as I was talking to before, was a big year for us. We were using developmental software before then, so everything was very limited. And then these jets have more in common with your iPhone than a traditional frontline fighter. So overnight, we got a new software load, the first combat load. It's called 3F. And we can now pull the full 9Gs. Our sensors got better. It unlocked the gun. So it's almost like a video game. And everything got significantly better. So we can pull 9Gs. We can fly Mach 1.6 and go up to 50,000 feet. The aerodynamic measurements like that, 50,000 feet, Mach 1.6, isn't a huge deal anymore. It's not in the 60s anymore, where it's how high and how fast you can go, or I think the F-16 was a good evolution of that, from, you know, not worrying about going Mach 2.5. Now it's about turning fifth generation fighters. Now it's about, like I talked before, having great sensors, having stealth, being able to network so you can go out there and hunt like a wolf pack. So there's a lot of differences. The paradigm has shifted, in my opinion, from some of those older aircraft. So I wouldn't just judge a plane based purely on like how fast it go or how high it could go.
Yeah, you're totally correct. Even if you don't fly at Mach 2, you're going to go in F-35 on the battlefield, and then you're going to smash everyone's face because you're going to be stealth. You're going to have sensor fusions, as you told, and you're going to have as well a better situational awareness than all those first generation aircraft. And I can tell you that even if the Mirage that I flew, the Mirage 2000-5, with only air-to-air missions, that's completely different. Great. So now you fly the F-35. What's your commitment with the Air Force? When are you supposed to leave?
So you owe 10 years post pilot training. So as soon as you get your wings, you owe 10 years to the Air Force. And I'm actually coming due on that at the end of this year. So I'm going to be transitioning to the reserves here at Luke. We only have right now like 3 or 4 spots. So I feel like I won the lottery getting one of those spots. But transitioning to the reserves means that I'm going to be able to fly the F-35 here at Luke, and actually the same squadron that I'm flying right now, just swap patches, for the next 15 to 20 years, which is pretty amazing. If my body can hold up, we have a lot of people with neck and back issues, but hopefully I'll be able to fly the F-35 until my mid-50s.
So you just confirmed that you're going to be flying the F-35 as a reserve guy. You're one of the luckiest guy in the world. You know that.
I feel so lucky, because at least in America, for pilots, the first 10 years are where you are in the squadron, you're flying a lot. And then from that 10-year mark to the 20-year mark is really where you start getting staff jobs, having to go to the Pentagon, having to fly a desk. So it can be fun. It can be challenging. It can be rewarding. You gain rank and you're now in charge of people, but you're really not. Your primary job is not to fly the aircraft. And most active duty pilots retire after 20 years. So I feel extremely fortunate to be able to stay here in Phoenix and fly the F-35 for knock on wood for the next 15, 20 years or so.
Yeah, amazing. What are you going to do transitioning? Do you want to go into commercial aviation, or do you want to, I don't know, settle a business or whatever?
So I've thought about the commercial aspect, and it seems like, well, right now is not a good time, but in about a year or two, I think it'll be a great time for the airline. So I've thought about that a little bit. I love aviation, but where my passion really is doing what you're doing, going out there and having a podcast and interviewing people and just seeing where that goes. For me, that really itches it's about the creativity, because even though as fighter pilots, we get to be really creative and plan missions, you're still in the military and it's a structured environment. And going out on your own as an entrepreneur, or as like being a podcast host, you really have all that weight on your shoulders. You're just out there on your own island, and that kind of appeals to me.
Yeah. Talking about your podcast that's named The Professional's Playbook, can you just tell us a bit about it?
Yeah, so I started about a year and a half ago, and I didn't have any experience in audio or visual. And as fighter pilots, our big thing is getting down in the debrief and developing lessons learned so you can be better for the next flight. And so I kind of had that mentality. And then in 2017, actually 2018, the city of Carefree, just north of Phoenix, asked on Memorial Day for a speaker who had been to combat. And so I gave that speech, and there's a woman in the crowd who worked for the Veterans Heritage Project, which is a nonprofit. And they wanted me to go to schools. And so I was going to school, speaking about the lessons learned I had developed being a fighter pilot and being in the Air Force. And so I thought having a podcast would be a good way to share that with people outside of the people in the same room that I was in. And I had a hunch that other careers kind of had that information locked up like we did as fighter pilots, not because it was classified or because we didn't want to share it, just because we were so busy we didn't have a chance to share, for instance, the human performance that we do, or the decision-making, or the mental training, that kind of stuff. And so, yeah, I started having on other guests, and I was able to have on the International Space Station commander, Terry Virts, came on. I had on the commander of the Thunderbirds, Brick Caldwell. I even had on some non-pilots like Adam Chire, the founder of Siri, that's in your iPhone. He came on and talked about developing that. So yeah. It's been an awesome experience, and I've certainly learned a lot, and hopefully I've been able to help out other people in terms of these people coming on and sharing their lessons learned.
Yeah, great. It's a very interesting podcast, and I can just recommend to all the listeners to have a look on this podcast. Do you have any major lessons learned from your professional career?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest lessons learned is how we debrief decisions. So after a flight, and we'll go out and we'll fly for about an hour and a half, we will come back and we will debrief between 2 and 6 hours that flight. And a lot of it's just admin going to and from the airspace. So oftentimes we're spending 6 hours out there debriefing a 20-minute, 40-minute phase of the mission. And we'll spend 90% of the time on the 10% that didn't go well. We break down errors into three different ways. So we have perception errors. So you're trying to build a mental model of what's going on in the world. So you're using your radar, you're using your eyes, you're using your ears. You build that up. And then from there, you have the next phase, making the correct decision. And so in the F-16 or F-35, we have a lot of tactics, thousands of tactics based on the picture that we're seeing. They're almost like plays in a football NFL playbook. And so we will choose the correct tactic. And sometimes people can choose the incorrect tactic, and there are ways to make them get better in terms of assimilating that information and being able to make those decisions on the spot. And then lastly, execution. So making sure that, essentially going back to sports, that you're kicking the ball the correct way and making sure that you're executing, you're shooting a valid shot. And so I kind of apply those lessons learned to my daily life. So I'll try to spend a little bit of time debriefing how each of the projects I'm doing is working and making sure that I'm perceiving it correctly, making sure I'm making the right decisions, making sure I'm executing it. And if not, trying to peel back the onion and really find out the root cause of that error so that I can fix it for next time. So that's one of the lessons learned. Another one is mental toughness. So as I talked to you before, you're going to make mistakes. You're going to have high pressure environments. We all do, whether you're flying a jet or you're giving a meeting or you're presenting at a meeting, you have high pressure moments and you have to really focus being in the present moment and executing. So I would say those are two of the lessons learned that I've applied to my daily life.
Yeah, awesome. Regarding these lessons learned and I think other areas, do you have any advice for the youngsters beginning or wanted to become a pilot, to become a fighter pilot?
I would say one thing is to play a sport. I think we have a lot of people, and that's what I'm doing now, is I'm teaching all this next generation of pilots coming through. I find the people who do well have played a sport, and not necessarily at a high level, but play a sport, at least in high school, because it really teaches you that toughness. You have to go out there and you have to perform. You're going to fail. So it teaches you how to win. It teaches you how to lose. It teaches you how to critique yourself and accept criticism, because you're going to get a lot of criticism throughout your career as a fighter pilot. But you have to accept that criticism, get better for the next game, and to support your teammates. So I really think sports helps out. And with the Gs that we pull, up to 9 Gs, I weigh 200 pounds with my gear on about 230. So at 9 Gs, I weigh over 2,000 pounds of force. So it's good to be in good shape. But if sports really isn't your thing, then I would recommend doing something competitive, whether it's to debate team or the chess team, something where you're getting criticism and have to mold yourself to become a better version of you the next day.
Yeah. Do you have anything remaining on your aviation bucket list?
Yeah. So we had a air show planned before this whole coronavirus thing happened, and we were going to get a F-35 to race a Bugatti Veyron.
Oh, really?
And yeah, we had it all set up, and 2 weeks before it got canceled. But I thought we had a whole cool profile set. I was not the one that was going to be flying it, but one of my friends was, and they were going to go down the runway, go up 10,000 feet in there, come back down, and it was going to be a photo finish at the end, as the Bugatti was going something crazy like 230 miles an hour. So we're going to have that air show either next year or the year after. And so that would be something that would be on my bucket list.
Yeah, talking about air shows, you have the F-35 demo team. Is that flown from Luke Air Force Base?
It was flown from Luke Air Force Base. It's since moved to Hill Air Force Base, but they've been doing some really, really cool stuff. Before I talked to you, that 2018 mark, we were more of a heritage team. The plane wasn't cleared for aerobatics, and so they would just fly in formation with like a P-51 Mustang, which was pretty cool to see, but it wasn't showcasing what the jet could do. And so I would recommend for listeners, go on to YouTube and type in F-35 demo team, and you'll see some crazy maneuvers, especially the high angle of attack regime, how much the jet can skid through the sky. It's a lot more than the F-16. The F-16 was limited in AOA because as the first real electric jet, it didn't have the computing power to be able to perform on the limit like that. And so now we do have the computing power and the massive stabs in the back of the F-35. They're maneuvering in split plane, and we're doing things called like a corkscrew, which is an intentional flat spin. And so you'll see some pretty cool maneuvers on there. And so it's kind of it's a shame with the coronavirus that all the air shows have been canceled, because they're continuing to tweak that routine, and it's pretty amazing to watch.
Talking about YouTube and so on, you can find as well the Justin's podcasts, the Professionals Playbook, on all the conventionals platform.
Yeah, anywhere where you have a podcast, just search for the Professionals Playbook and it should be the first one that pops up.
Thank you very much, Justin, for your time on the 90s podcast. It was a real pleasure having you here, and it was very nice to learn a little bit about the F-35. Thank you very much, Justin.
Matteo, thanks for having me on. It's been a pleasure to be on here.
You've been listening to the 90s podcast, an aviation podcast. If you liked this show, subscribe and share on all conventional platforms. You can as well follow us on Instagram and Facebook on the 90s podcast accounts. Thanks for listening, and fly safe.